And so here's a phrase you might have heard. Well, here's another nice mess you've gotten me into. This is Oliver Hardy to Stan Laurel in a number of the comedy films they made together for almost 30 years. Not only are many of their sight gags some of the funniest ever seen, even today, but the genuine affection and friendship shown between these two comic characters had a parallel in real life. Englishman Stan Laurel and American Oliver Hardy were also best friends. In addition to mutuality of understanding, the phrase being simpatico comes to mind. Sometimes our friends do get us into messes. Some embarrassing, some touching, some dangerous, some sad, and some as funny as anything Laurel and Hardy ever demonstrated on the big screen. Really, in addition to the serious times that we spend, friends are people to have fun with. In that regard, I sometimes feel that in our adult friendships, we may resemble the children we once were. We share our toys, we tease and joke, we hurt each other's feelings, get mad, and then make up. Events in my last week may be skipping out of consciousness, but I still remember a number of my childhood friends, the games we played, the comic books we shared, the movies we went to see. I still remember visiting the home of Jeff Ricketts and his brother, whose name I don't remember, and it was amazing because they had created in their two bedrooms this elaborate play world of Tinker Toys, and this is pre-Lego, sorry, but all these elaborate little tiny plastic figures, all of whom had names. It was an amazing world, and I was privy to it. And that's what happens in our friendships. Thomas More wrote in his book, what was his book? I read it. Let me borrow your glasses, Vicki. I wrote this down somewhere. What's the title of his book? Soulmates. Thank you. I knew that. I didn't have to look that up. So I don't know if you know, Soulmates has been a book that's been out for some years now. But I thought what he said there was really interesting. He says that every friend represents a world. And consequently, as we make friends, we encounter and explore different worlds. So that was what that friendship with Jeff Ricketts was like for me. It was like entering this magical world, and it was weird to me in some ways, but I really enjoyed it, and I remember even at the time admiring his imagination. Our best friendships broaden our horizons and increase our depths. We enjoy those new worlds. And we also find our abilities and proclivities sustained. Without the friendship between Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, not only would their lives have been diminished, but the work that they did bringing women's rights to America would probably not have been as successful. They were, in fact, a dynamic duo. They worked together very successfully. They spoke. They supported legislation in individual states and national legislation to further the rights of American women. And another famous friendship existed between writers Professor C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, each famous for the worlds that they created, Lewis's Narnia and Tolkien's Middle Earth. They became best of friends not only because they believed in the power of myth to recreate possibility, but also because of their shared Christian faith. Vicki and I were fortunate to visit an exhibition at Oxford's Bodleian Library this summer, and it took as its theme some of the works of the foremost modern writers of children's fantasy literature. They're informally known as the Oxford School because they all had connections with Oxford, England, either the university or the town. C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Susan Cooper, Alan Garner, and Philip Pullman. The Bodleian Library has their works as part of its treasure trove, and many of them were on exhibit. Did you know that Tolkien was a magnificent artist, that he actually illustrated a number of the scenes from The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit? And C.S. Lewis drew his own map of Narnia. You know, it's not just that you write something, it's that you have to get that world in your head. And they did. They were also, those two men, part of a larger circle of Oxford friends called the Inklings. It was a group that met for almost 20 years between the early 1930s and late 1949. Now, I'll tell you a little secret about J.R.R. Tolkien. His fantasy world that he brought to us was incredible, but he is still described as one of the most boring lecturers ever to be at Oxford University. Apparently, at least half of his lecture was delivered to the blackboard, upon which he wrote indecipherable notes. So we don't always see what we get in terms of the people in our lives. Reading and discussing each member's unfinished literary endeavors was the principal purpose of the meetings, which were friendly and supportive and great fun. The Inklings were loyal to one another and to their group, but they also challenged each other. If there was a line or a chapter that just didn't ring true, they would speak up. But it was always done in a constructive and appreciative setting. And I think that's what's so important. And that's what we get from our best friendships. Our friends don't remain silent in the face of some of our failings, but they bring those failings to our attention kindly. And that's a gift. It's easier to correct a failing when it's pointed out in kindness and in love. Well, I'm touching on our summer travels, and I'll refer again to those other great friends. Please do not mention the Three Stooges and Laurel and Hardy in the same breath. Laurel and Hardy were, in truth, great friends, and it was shown in all of their films. Rather far from Oxford, the town of Ulverston in the Lake District is the birthplace of Stan Laurel. Ulverston features the Laurel and Hardy statue unveiled in 2009 and the Laurel and Hardy Museum, which Vicki and I visited. Here's a little guide to the town of Ulverston with the statue of Stan and Ollie on the front cover. And if you would like to learn other attractions of the town of Ulverston, for example, their print fest in May, an exhibition of original prints by contemporary artists. And there's more, then just see me after the service is over. Whatever happened to them on screen or off, Laurel and Hardy were a team. In real life, they watched their popularity wane as they left behind the 20 to 25 minute comedies that were so successful and plunged generally disappointingly into feature films. They were there for each other as their multiple marriages fell apart and as they grew older and more infirm. In a sense, these two very funny men offer us a paradigm for our best friendships, captured in the phrase, there for each other. Following Oliver Hardy's death, for the remaining 8 years of his life, Stan Laurel refused to perform in Ollie's absence. He even turned down director Stanley Kramer's offer of a significant part in his 1963 movie, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. It just didn't seem right, Stan felt, to perform without the other half of his friendship, his team, and his comedy genius. So yes, in our deepest friendships, we are there for each other. Through cancer, aging, hilarity, and heartbreak. There for each other through job loss, promotion, marriage, and divorce. There for each other through bridge, backgammon, and bankruptcy. I would never say that friendship is easy today. Cyberspace and computers present challenges as well as opportunities. We live in developments and subdivisions, and sometimes we don't always get to know the people who are our neighbors. Studies and polls reveal that Americans, by a 2-to-1 majority, would prefer to have deeper friendships rather than more friends. To me, it's really odd that companies today discourage friendships in the workplace since we spend more and more time in our workplaces. Studies repeatedly show how important our friendships are to us. There's an Australian study, you can find it online, 2012 or 2013, I'm not sure, it's very recent. So the question was asked, which is the most important to you? If you were to stay at your company, of these characteristics, which is most significant? The highest rating at 67%, compatibility with other people in the company, versus 48% voting for salary as being of central importance. It's not a surprise, I think, in some sense, because we yearn for those connections that friendship bestows. Being alone is not what most of us fear. What we dread is feeling lonely and abandoned in our moments of greatest joy and our times of deepest sorrow. Friends are indeed the companions of our life journey. Because we need them and want them, it doesn't mean they'll appear for us. Friends can be tough to find. My experience is that those people who offer friendships, who are warm and caring and fun to be with, who are thoughtful and reflective, attract friends. Sometimes there's somebody in your neighborhood who acts as the fulcrum around which friendships grow. We can't just wait for friends to appear. The phrase comes to mind, it is in giving that we receive. So what might true, deep, abiding friendship look like? I know the following is dramatic, and some would say melodramatic, but it points to the depth of affection and caring that true friendship offers us at its most profound. While these few lines can't be substantiated as true, I know that words and incidents such as these have been true and are true today. My friend isn't back from the battlefield, sir. Request permission to go out and find him. Permission refused, says the officer. I don't want you to risk your life for a man who is most certainly dead. But the soldier disobeys orders and goes anyway, and 3 hours later comes back, seriously wounded, and dragging the corpse of his friend. The officer, of course, is furious. I told you he was dead. Now you're wounded. Was it worth going out there to drag back a corpse? Oh, it was, sir. Because when I got to him, he was still alive, and he said to me, Jack, I knew you'd come.
Some of you may have wondered if Mark and I are planning a move to Britain anytime soon. The answer to that question is no, unless we can talk our grown children into doing the same. However, it is true that we visit frequently. For not only is the UK well-suited to our sense of scale and landscape taste, but it also answers our heart's desire to see family, because that is what our friends who live there have become. I met Maura on our first trip to England 31 years ago, and we instantly considered each other the soul sister our parents hadn't provided us with. Since that time, we have shared countless phone calls, letters, life-changing births and deaths. We have laughed and cried and listened to music and sipped tea and water. And over the years, Maura and her late husband, Aidan, added their list of friends to ours. There's Marjorie and Philip and Beryl and Barbara, and Jane and Glenda and Barry and Sinead. But before I bore you with all the other names, I will just say that Mark and I treasure every frequent flyer mile that makes free trips across the pond possible. Because however repetitive and pedantic our journeys may seem to some, we are grateful beyond measure for this extended family we now call our own. Still, there is no way to get around the fact that Britain is a massively different country from our own, although we do share a few things in common. One such interest is theater. And when in Britain, Mark and I attend as many plays as our budget will allow. But we've always had one rule. No American playwrights. This summer, we broke that injunction 3 times. Once for the Book of Mormon, for which we could actually get tickets, and they were cheaper than what the Denver production cost. Once for Fences, a Pulitzer Prize winning play seldom performed in our country, and which was, on what turned out to be the hottest day of the year, performed in an air-conditioned theater. And once for the play Titanic, because, oh, I don't know. Perhaps because we had just learned that due to a broken pipe, our Fort Collins home was being flooded. However, I mention our rule breaking primarily so that I can share a line from August Wilson's play Fences, which has haunted me ever since I heard it delivered. Centered on the thwarted dreams of a black man living in Philadelphia during the 1920s, Fences tells the story of Troy, a hard-working garbage collector who desperately wants a better and more rewarding life for his son. But Troy has a tough way of sharing his dreams. He is strict. He yells instead of hugging. He imposes curfews, and although his son is a talented athlete, Troy doesn't allow him to play football, insisting instead that he find a job so that he can shore up his opportunities to do well in life. In fact, Troy seems so unsupportive that at one point his son questions whether his father even likes him, to which Troy's roaring response is, "I don't have to like you. All I have to do is provide for you and give you guidance." Troy then goes on to rattle off a laundry list of all the things he has done and continues to do, all of which, he suggests, have nothing to do with love. Yet in spite of his very rough edges, Troy was a likable anti-hero. Perhaps this is why his take on the relationship between liking and caring made me think. What motivations do need to be in place before we engage in kind and helpful acts? When people learn that I have been a vegetarian for over 25 years, they are invariably surprised that I'm not a huge lover of animals, that it isn't a particular fondness for cows or pigs or sheep or even dogs that leads me to believe we shouldn't kill and eat other sentient beings, but rather a fundamental respect for life. But what about the people who help us out or whom we choose to assist? Do they need to be our friends? Do we even need to know their names? Thinking back to Tennessee Williams' play, A Streetcar Named Desire, Blanche DuBose memorably states that she has always depended on the kindness of strangers, implying that random acts can benefit us all, and that family and friends, however near and dear, may not always be the ones who nurture our souls or support our spirits. So maybe Troy is right. Of course, as soon as I start to wrap my head around that idea, I remember the words of the well-known American cowboy and social commentator, Will Rogers, who said that a stranger was just a friend we hadn't yet met. And only slightly to the left of this point, we have Francis Bacon, an English statesman, scientist, and philosopher, who felt that if you were gracious and courteous to strangers, it proved you were a true citizen of the world and not just a member of your own clan. So in the final reckoning, perhaps what comes closest to the truth is that family and friends and strangers are all necessary for our well-being. This idea was given further weight in a number of lovely ways this summer. Attending a music festival in Wales, I was brought to tears when on the last day of our week, over 4,000 strangers joined hands and sang Auld Lang Syne. Comfortable in the fact that we had just shared a profound and moving experience and that we hope to do so again in the future. And I couldn't help but be touched when a young girl working in a pizza restaurant we stopped by inexplicably asked me to come back and see her in a few minutes. And when I did, she smiled and shyly handed me a little bottle of pink glitter because she had noticed the sparkles on my cheeks. Other acts of kindness included the Tesco's clerk who waved us on with a wink when we pointed out she hadn't charged us for our new reusable canvas grocery bag, and the gentleman who went out of his way to drive us to our accommodation when we were lost. Even the cashier at St. Martin's in the Field insisted we take the bread and jar of strawberry jelly when we came up a few pence short at the register. Each of these gestures, so freely given, enhanced our trip and made it more memorable. And what can we say about the people in Fort Collins, who, when they heard that when that burst water pipe started filling our crawl space with water, saw that plumbers and excavators were called, or rushed to our house to dig up and repot countless plants so that they wouldn't suffer a crushing death when the backhoe arrived to destroy our yard. Not content to rescue only plants and pipes, our friends also lifted and moved an untold number of flagstones, stacking them neatly by the garage door so that they can be used again. And with each of these heavy tasks, our load was lightened and our hearts filled with joy. Every friend who came to our rescue in Fort Collins and every stranger who brightened our travel was paying it forward. And the same act is true every time a member of Foothills UU congregation shows up on someone's door to deliver a meal to a person they may or may not know, or makes a hospital or nursing home visit, or sends a caring card, or makes a phone call just to chat. We form churches like Foothills in part because we need to be close, and we are kind to those people in the world who we do not know, because our better natures inform us this is how peace is made. We sing songs and extend the hand of fellowship and serve the homeless dinner and give them a place to sleep. We share social hour coffee and adult enrichment classes and small group ministries and choir nights because to be in beloved community is what allows us to survive. And whether we are at work or on vacation or just minding our own business, it will always be people, not money, not commerce, not religion or politics, or even committee meetings that make our lives meaningful. And as far as Mark and I are concerned, as long as this world of ours keeps going round and round, we want to enjoy the spinning with you in whatever ways we can, whether we know your name already or have yet to make your acquaintance.